Oh, the shape up or get. If you've let all the fans down.
Can we not lock this?
It's a fact. I'm not playing mind games. I'm talking about facts.
I always said if I was Aladici, I would probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
The answer questions on anything. Religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems.
Look at his face! Just look at his face!
None of you, except for those two, have done anything to justify the money that you earn. None of you! Disgrace!
And I suggest you shut up and show more football.
All right, welcome along to Team 33. I'm Raf Giallo. As always, you can get in touch with us on Twitter. That's at Team 33. We're also on Facebook and also on iTunes. You can find some of our interviews on the YouTube channel, like this week's one where myself and Jonathan Higgins spoke to Thomas Granemark, the Liverpool throw-in coach. So that's coming up. We're going to play that out later on today, but it's already been podcasted. So as I said, iTunes and also the Off the Ball website, you'll find the full podcast there. Now, Joe Coffey is back with the laptop in
Raf,
new professional setting.
The laptop is a permanent fixture now.
Okay.
As I said off mic, I'm bringing an air of professionalism to this setup now. Which,
it's almost like it was lacking all these 5 years.
I felt that over the last almost five years, that what we were really missing was a laptop. So now at least when we say some mad statistic that turns out to be wrong, we can tell each other we're wrong much quicker.
Can we use you as the guy, like the guy from Joe Rogan that's just Joe, get this up.
Yeah.
Get it up on the screen.
Derek Ryan.
Hey, Raf.
End of call.
How are you?
Jonathan Higgins.
Hello.
And Killian Woods makes his return with hot takes, I believe, are on the way.
I don't
as well.
Think you've been on since you said Alex Ferguson was a nothing manager.
Was a fraud.
No, I was.
Fraud.
I was.
Fraud Ferguson.
I was. And I refused to debate anyone until I got my thoughts.
Alex Fraud.
And I'm still refusing to debate anyone.
Yeah, we're not going to bring that up again. That did not go down well.
The end is really tough to argue against because, and Derek as well. Like, Derek, because you're just so staunchy and
I know
you're. But
Enda
says everything with such. Like, your accent makes it real hard to argue against you because you say something with so much like enthusiasm. I have this kind of slurry Meath accent with slurry and slurry Meath accent. And just really, I don't even convince myself.
Because you were talking absolute nonsense.
No, that's not true.
That was the problem.
That's not true. I mean,
Killian,
misunderstood for my time.
Like, did you argue this at home with your friends? Like, and did any of them agree with you?
No one, none of my friends listen to me when I'm talking this. That's why I'm in here talking to you guys about it. No one else will listen to me.
Well, I see Harry Kane's made the football match this time around. They just cut to him there on the screen.
Oh yes, we're recording this as Tottenham play Ajax in the UEFA Champions League
semi-final
first
strange,
leg.
The previous game when they beat Man City, that he didn't bother making the trip up. I have to say.
No, he filmed himself in front of his TV.
He filmed himself
with a very awkward looking.
I don't think it's that strange because he's probably at home getting treatment or doing more treatment.
Yeah. I mean, I'm obviously just nitpicking. But
it's also a better way to watch football. Maybe he just likes watching on telly.
I mean, like, and it just seems so. It just kind of seems so forced, like the celebration. Like,
oh, the
yes!
Video was so cringe. It was so cringe.
Right, wow.
Yeah, well, he is a vacuum of charisma. But anyway,
he's a great footballer.
It's a bit harsh.
It's a bit harsh.
No, it is not harsh.
He's a
very harsh.
He's
on
a Galway man as well.
I thought that wouldn't be a good thing for people from Mayo.
I mean, to be honest with you, he's from Connacht, so it's good enough for me.
West is best,
as we
West
said,
is best. Yeah, yeah. I do
agree
with that.
The other one up the west and expletive of the rest.
But speaking of punditry, which we're going to bring up in a little bit, we've got a clip of Scholes that Killian actually tweeted out 2 or 3 weeks ago, but he hasn't been back since, so we've saved it until now. But just the Granemark interview that we did, Jonathan. Obviously, Andy Gray was not very open about the idea of throw-in coaches and those kind of things.
Yeah,
and
very much the what we call the dinosaur attitude, really.
Neanderthal, I believe, is the other term.
Yeah, very much against the modern way of coaching. And we've seen Guardiola, we've seen Klopp, we've even seen the likes of Michelin, you know, almost take the money ball approach to various levels of success. They're in a small club to play in United in the Champions League. We've seen Nangle and now at Hoffenheim going to Leipzig next, who really taking the positive sides of the game and looking at the small margins, looking at a positive way, but you still have the other side of the coin, don't you?
Yes, Andy Gray and Richard Keys, who are of course ensconced in Qatar. But now it's the clip of Paul Scholes discussing Payet, and then Killian, we'll just get your thoughts on why this seemed to rile you particularly, but here it is.
You have to think he made a mistake probably leaving, didn't he?
Look,
what's he done since?
Yeah.
I can't tell you. Where's he now, Marcel?
Actually, he didn't go to the club that he probably wanted to go. He wanted to get
The only thing I told him that, Dimitri, if you go
go to Manchester United.
Yeah,
go to, or go to Juventus, or go to their team, yeah. Don't go to Marseille. But he wanted to go home. Fair enough.
If you think of Dimitri Payet now, the only time you think about him is his time at West Ham.
West Ham, yeah.
Well, what else? Yeah. I don't see another time in his career where I've even knew it. I don't think I knew him.
All right, that is Paul Scholes. He's alongside Slaven Bilic and also the BT Sports presenter as well in there discussing Payet. So, Killian, what was it about this clip that particularly got you
nervous?
I need
to remind myself what kind of hot take I had, because you never know looking back whether it's going to be any good. Sometimes, you know, it can be just a lot of crap. I suppose just kind of picking out, it's part of a wider problem I feel I have at the moment, whereas there's this very much kind of, I suppose, first of all, Anglo-centric. It's very hard to talk when you're all watching an Ajax goal, but and that's happening.
Well,
that's happened days previous.
When you're finished the Payet point, it leads lovely into a point that Gary Breen was making about Spurs and Ajax.
So, like, I suppose there is the Anglo-centric problem I have with this football at the moment, whereas essentially if it didn't happen with an English team, against an English team...
Or for Real or Barca.
Yeah, it didn't happen. So it was essentially him slating that, you know, Payet was a nobody before... He went to, came from Marseille to West Ham. He was petulant for wanting to leave, and he was a nobody then once he left, even though he did have a limited appearance in the Europa League final. Mm-hmm. He did go off injured in that, as far as I remember. But it's just a kind of very, and that's what I hate about pros, and I hate at the moment about a lot of them. I'm painting them all with the same brush here. So it's a bit. I'm trying to be fair in a way to some who are quite good, but I feel there is this kind of like a football person. Like you're a football man, a football person. I get it from my point of view, and any point outside of that, because as well, they're very dismissive of any other attitudes coming at it, which would be kind of thinking that maybe there is life beyond the Premier League. And there's this very football man, I think, at the moment. It's a term that Eamon Dunphy is probably, he's not a football man. And he's using other people who would know a lot about the game. And I feel it's kind of all across punditry, where it's this anti anything not English and anti anything that's said by someone who didn't play football, which is a very naive way to look at it. And it's very naive to think that other people that didn't play the game don't have a clue about football. Because
isn't there an element to that? Yeah, like,
it's snobbery. It's very snobby. And I feel it, sorry to cut across you. And it also, I think, it really reflects in, getting very deep now, just going from one Paul Scholes clip, it reflects in a lot of the commentary around the protests out of the Aviva recently, where the balls are thrown on the pitch. And it's not even a Venn diagram. There's a circle over here of footballers and a circle over here of non-footballers, and they're polar opposite opinions. I don't know what people's opinions are here, but I think there's no better way to protest. But the footballer's opinion was protests shouldn't be involved in football. They shouldn't have done that. And it's very much a football's man opinion to it. And it's very not, and that's what I think, I'm going mad from this one Payet opinion to that, but that's what I feel it is at the moment. There's this very much a footballer's opinions of football, which over here, which is kind of broadly very cliche, very predictable, and very anti-fan. And then there's fans' football opinions of football over here, which is much more broad, much more, and not all fans, not all footballers, but
yeah, I think you've been very harsh on a lot of good, very good pundits too.
I'd
agree with you, and certainly in this clip and in a lot of clips, there's a lot of laziness with regards to punditry. In that they play the game, so they think they can just rock up and watch a game and talk about it and think that's fine. You know, what we saw with Sky Sports, for example, over the last decade or so, and how they've stepped up the thing on Monday Night Football, Gary Neville, Jamie Carragher stepped up the game an awful lot in that 10 years and kind of brought the punditry game to a much higher degree, much higher level, I think, over the last decade or so.
Yeah,
but there's still plenty of pundits, and I'm not just saying Sky, there's still plenty of pundits out there who rely on the fact that they used to play the game. And then my opinion counts for a lot more because I used to play the game.
Yeah, the point I agree with you, Killian, though, it's they seem to have a blind spot for anything, as you said, outside the Premier League or that kind of level or the England squad. And that's, I think, where the issue is. And I don't know Neville failed in Spain anyway, but beside the point. Like, I didn't say that to his face when I met him, by the way.
I think if you're looking at punditry in general, of course, there are exceptions to the rule that some pundits can do the analytical stuff very well. But if you're looking at, say, even Roy Keane last week, where he's talking about intensity and all that, and like Ken Early wrote an article in the Times about this,
this week.
This week,
where he's making the point about Roy Keane and how everything is talked about, like intensity and will to get the ball, but actually the way football has changed now is that, like, I mean, you've got pundits like Keane who, in fairness, are 20 years out of the, like, well, you know, almost 20 years out of the game. And he was making the point that then your other one is Souness, who is even further. Now, Graham, they're both excellent analysts, no doubt about it. And it's very entertaining. And Graham Souness is a great reader of the game. But same issue you have with a lot of pundits in that the game changes so rapidly, like in the space of 10 years, that many of them fail to recognise that it is not the same game that they played. But they still apply the whole old thing of desire. And like the desire and
yeah,
want to
win. But I think
just
Keane can't seem to see anything outside of his own personal experience or what he's like. I think that's the only thing.
And that singular, I guess, experience of if you win your battle, the team will win the game. Yeah. And as Ken early pointed out, that's not necessarily the case in a kind of more team environment.
And surely Keane, above all people, should know that the game has changed a lot. He has had the opportunity to look at it from another side. I don't mean that in a disrespectful way, but he has had an opportunity in a couple of occasions to realise it's not just glory, glory, Man United. I'll hit someone hard in our tackle here. We'll press really hard. The game has evolved.
Look at what Liverpool and Man City are doing.
They've
it's
taken the game
kind of,
and
include. Kind of football.
I'd include Spurs as well in that. To be fair, as well, they have taken the game to a different level. Mm. And there's almost like a. I think I'll have to go as far as saying there's a kind of a laziness in a lot of the punditry that we see. It's almost like I used to play the game and that's it and that's enough for me and. I'm not going to research. I'm not going to look at a different way. And no, it's like, this is the way it is and that's it. And why is it that way? Well, that's the way I was taught and that's the way it was. There's almost like a staleness. There's a resentment to, like, even simple things like culture has changed a lot in the last couple of years. And of course, football has changed a lot as well. And there seems to be huge resistance to that. And then there's kind of, it's almost like an old boys club in a way that's like, no, this is it. This is the way it was. This is the way it will be. And it's never going to change when the reality is it's completely away from
exactly,
that.
Exactly.
Even with what Keane was saying, what Keane was saying is completely out of touch with the game as well. He's saying that, you know, the ball's 2 yards away, close the ball down, the ball is the danger. That's not how football works now. You're not closing the ball down, you're closing the space down. Mm. You're stopping the player from making that pass or you're even thinking 2 or 3 steps ahead of him. You're closing down the space that if you allow him to make that pass, then the person who receives that ball can't make the pass that he will have to make if he gets the ball. So that Keane is actually completely out of touch at the minute. And he's great for sound bites and he's great for analysis. For example, like Pogba, for example, calling him out on his nonsense interview after the game. That's what Keane is good at and that's what he should stick to, whereas I don't think he can really take his analysis of the game really that seriously. Especially based off his managerial experience as well, because
Forrest isn't exactly going well.
Exactly, so it doesn't really show, or the evidence isn't there to back it up that he actually understands the modern game that well. But it also, I think this also comes into the argument around of having a female pundit and some of the comments online when the likes of Alex Scott is on Sky Sports. She's actually quite good at it, but people are still saying, how can Alex Scott understand senior football at this level when she never played to that level? That's not the point. Don't need to play at that level to understand the game.
Yeah.
It's a classic example of good footballers don't necessarily make good managers.
Exactly.
And we've seen the opposite in the spectrum many, many times. Some of the best managers are people that are maybe not at the extreme level of the game, but they look at it because they've had to, they realize they're not the best player. They have to analyze the game a bit more. Like even to stay Klopp, he was a bang average footballer, but has gone on to sort of thing. So it's one of the things, and I think it's one of the reasons why the likes of the alternative coverage of the game, you know, well, obviously social media has kind of distorted everything completely, but you look at the popularity of, like, say, fan-based media outlets and stuff like that.
Journalists, and the
avenue then of podcasts and, you know, various opinions. It's just a freshness because a lot of people are sick of the same old, and it's hard to blame people.
Because I thought, Killian, the most effective thing about the Paille clip was the fact that Bilic gave such a pragmatic explanation of what was happening.
Yeah, it was nice to hear him, probably a bit too late, set the record straight about what happened.
It gave at that time, everyone's going mad, going, oh my God, he's a mercenary and blah, blah, blah. But like, it did go back to the whole thing that we talk about often, which was like the fact that
it went back to the whole thing that, like, sorry, I'm actually tearing them apart, really. But and I just want to finish on a point in that as well. But it does go back to the whole thing that you're looking at. You're so used to that completely threw me.
It's really hard, isn't it?
Sorry, I'm going to stop lifting my arms every time I take a half decent chance.
No, it's just that Bilic gives such a and it goes back to the whole thing of that we'd often talked about here, where you forget that football is a professional job, you know, and that, like, I mean, Bilic was talking about the fact that he wanted to go home and he wanted to effectively work at home.
Yeah. Can I jump in on that? Yeah. Or do you have something?
Well, I have something to say, but you can...
That's the thing as well. I felt that, like, what was quite naive and what Scholes should have realised, and look, and I tried to talk from a point of experience of watching the game and seeing what unfold. I can't say what it's like in a dressing room, and I wouldn't try. And again, I would get a caveat if I was trying to do that. I would say, look, speaking from no experience, with Scholes, how is he, as a person who lived a sheltered life in Manchester United for the same club for years and years and years, went away, came back to the same club for one season, how could he possibly give insight into what Pae was thinking? Pae, exactly that. There was, and again, I don't know what's going through Pae's head, so I'll say that as a caveat before I finish, start my point. Maybe he was just homesick. Maybe, yeah. Like, you know, England, I think London is, I'm not going to say the word, but it is, it's a whatever hole. It's a crap place to live.
Well,
I don't like London at all. I couldn't imagine living in London.
It's a hot so, it's a massive international city.
Yeah. So maybe Pae didn't want to live in London. I was just speculating, maybe he didn't want to live in London. Didn't cross Scholes' mind that he would earn probably nearly the same wage in Marseille for one of the biggest clubs in France, have a better chance of playing much higher level of football, maybe winning a better chance of starting the French team. You never know what's playing going in the background. But Scholes, none of this was going through his head. It's not the Premier League, it's not West Ham. He didn't want to play. He is a bad sportsman for not wanting to play, bad professional. He could just be homesick. Yeah. And earn the same wage in France for a really, really big club. I've been to Marseille Stadium. It is amazing. Amazing atmosphere week in, week out. And he was just so naive to be giving his opinion on something he has no idea.
And I just think that's the point that gets lost sometimes with punditry, even with football punditry. It's amazing is that, you know, like, what makes a good manager sometimes is the fact that they're good man managers. And, like, it's the fact that it's managing players that might be homesick or have personal issues going on, so that they can concentrate on playing. And, like, sometimes it does come down to simple things like that he just doesn't want to live in the country. And if that's it, like, I mean, like, any of us, you know, could have had the opportunity to work abroad or live abroad, and I'm sure we've all done it or come close to doing it. I think most of it, I've done it, you've done it, Raf.
Yeah.
What about the rest?
There's a horrible empty feeling from being homesick. You know, it's a horrible feeling.
It's not fun, like.
And it doesn't matter how far you are away from home, it's how often you can get home is the homesickness. And I think that's the thing Scholes just wasn't speaking from any experience on.
And there is two key points there as well. It's his assumption that playing in Marseille is a step down from West Ham somehow.
Yes.
It's not the Premier League. And that is something that...
Marseille is a far bigger club than West Ham.
Exactly.
At least they've won league titles.
And
no
I think,
to West Ham. Like.
I think the marketing behind the Premier League has done a great job to brainwash football fans to think that as well. I mean, I had an argument with my friends recently enough about the quality of opposition in the La Liga compared to the Premier League, and my argument was there is not a big difference between if you take the top six out of England, compare those clubs below that in the La Liga compared to the Premier League, and there's not that much difference. There's not that much difference between Sevilla and Leicester, or the likes of Valencia and, say, Wolves, for example, but simply because they're watching them week in, week out, they're basing their opinion off that. And another one that a point that I'd like to touch on is his assumption of what is going on behind Pae, and it kind of fits in with the whole Paul Pogba narrative at the minute, that he's a troublemaker, he's causing hassle in the dressing room. And people are basing this off the fact that he's on social media taking videos and looking happy. Like, maybe he's just a happy guy, maybe he's just a bubbly guy. And by all accounts, any evidence behind this is based purely on assumption. There's no evidence to say Paul Pogba is a bad guy or causing...
There are videos from the World Cup, like, that France would have shot behind the scenes, and I've seen a few of them. The only person who's talking and being that kind of leader who's giving speeches, now whether you believe speeches have an effect, it is Pogba himself.
Yeah,
that's actually, like, Lloris is actually standing there with the rest of the, and he's supposed to be the captain. He's not.
I think he seems to be different in France though than in Manchester United. I don't know if that...
There's tons of players that have come out and said, in defence of Pogba, saying that he's an excellent guy, he's a lovely guy, and they all love him. So,
But at the moment, he's also, like, he's not playing particularly well at the moment, and he's also calling, like, talking about moving to Real Madrid, apparently. And also Mourinho obviously had a massive issue with him as well. So there is evidence.
Well, like, okay,
it's Mourinho saying it, which I know can be
nonsense. I'm not by any stretch of the imagination defending Pogba. I think his performances have been completely below par, and it does look like he's trying to force an exit. And if that's true, that's true. But also, again, it kind of comes into the Payet situation. Payet forced his exit as well, but he was homesick. And maybe Pogba wants to move to Real Madrid because he wants to win trophies. And that's
United,
not
and United, well, United is like no different than Arsenal. They have a load of work to do there. There's loads of crap players.
He can see. And does he want to wait around for the next 5 years before they win?
He's at Real Madrid, Zidane, going a big rebuilding job.
Yeah,
there,
exactly.
And they have the money to do it.
Zidane,
and they will go and do it.
Zidane will say to him, "You can be the pivotal player on this team. We can with the fulcrum of the team. We can build it all around you."
It's the football and culture. It's everything that goes with it. Like. Everybody knows that United need a lot of work. They need a lot of work to define their style as well, define everything. Whereas he can see the card on the end of the stick is to go to the likes of Real Madrid or whatever and fit into a culture that he will know straight away. And
be the superstar and be
into that kind of style of football as well. That you know, because even with like Solskjaer's come back, he hasn't changed the style of football that much. It's still pretty much a counter attacking team. It's not going to be this flairy kind of guy that can kind of swerve around the middle of the pitch, which potentially he might be able to do at Madrid. But again, you have to go back at it, and it's something I was guilty of when I was younger as well. And I think you're always a bit more conscious of it when it's your club and a big star player leaves your big club. Like I remember going back as a kid, almost heartbroken when Michael Owen left, and I was like, why would you do that? Torres was something similar, and the last really one was Suarez when he was left, and you know, you almost like hold a resentment towards these players. But then you get a bit more wiser behind the ears when you get older and you look back on it. Yeah, that was the right thing to do. Liverpool were a mess. Yeah. How could you turn down? I remember it was actually the couple of days before the Champions League final last season, and we had to stop over in Barcelona on the way. And I remember walking down the streets of Barcelona with another mate of mine, a big diehard Liverpool fan as well. And I remember walking down the street, gorgeous sunny day. And just I love Barcelona anyways, but it looked so beautiful. And I remember walking down, it's like, Jesus, I don't really blame Coutinho for wanting to live here every day of the week. You know, but that's a different type of mindset that people don't, because it's your club and you're like, oh, this my club where it's X,
Y,
Z.
You think he owes an allegiance to your club, yeah. But he doesn't. Yeah. He doesn't owe anything. He owes what he signed in his contract. And Pogba as well, just to go back to him, if he goes to Real Madrid, he won't be criticised for his social media activity. He'll be almost loved and adored for it.
That'll
the superstar Galactico personality that he has is perfect for Real Madrid. And if you're looking at his career options solely as a career, you're looking at Zidane, who has won numerous Champions League titles, and then you're looking at Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, who got Cardiff relegated and won the league.
And I'm
home.
Sure even
like,
from
who,
a
which one are you choosing? As a 24-year-old who's going to be judged on trophies at the end of his career, he's got that World Cup,
and you've a short time frame to make it happen.
Exactly. I think Real Madrid is the best option for him.
Like, I think for all all parties involved in the deal, I think a move to Real Madrid for a good price would be the best all around.
You could argue that if hindsight's 20/20, but if Gerrard had left Liverpool after winning the Champions League, he probably would have won a Premier League and stuff with it, because he didn't actually he wouldn't have lost anything from leaving Liverpool after they won the Champions League.
I think it was
League.
One FA Cup.
Yeah,
a couple of European nights after that. That's the cold reality of
it. I mean, look, it's all great. I always eat an O and all that.
Well, I suppose with the likes of Gerrard or whatever, it's a little bit different from your
he nearly
Poets.
Did, though.
He nearly did, but it's a different... They're kind of embedded into that mindset because they've grown up in there and they have an emotional attachment. There's a family attachment. It's the club they would have supported. With the likes of Pogba and Payet. And look, take the personal point of view. Pogba, I assume, would have idolised Zidane as a kid. You would imagine that was a player he would have watched. Like, why wouldn't he want to go in a kind of I won't say nicer football culture, but a warmer culture, a more cultured city, to play a role that suits him best for one of his heroes? It seems a no-brainer, really, doesn't it?
Just to finish, on it, the one that I did mention, Gary Green, and just because we're watching the game, I just thought it was very... I was listening to the Premier League show on Today FM on Saturday when Spurs were playing West Ham, and Gary Green was just making the point that even though Spurs have lost something like it's 11 or 12 Premier League matches now, He was saying, oh, he thought, like, he was just saying, oh, I think they'll take care of Ajax, no problem.
He said he couldn't see any way that Spurs would. And again, there's nothing wrong with, and I read, my gut reaction was,
and
that's a crap
I'm
opinion.
Not having a go at him. I'm just saying I was surprised.
And my gut reaction was, that's just ridiculous. Read his opinion. Oh, I see, okay, I see where you're kind of coming from. But then, still not, the evidence is there.
Like, I mean,
think that just, on the face
of
it just looks like, saying, it looks like lazy punditry. And I'm just, because on the face of it, all the facts are there that Ajax are going to do exactly what they're doing to Spurs right now.
Yeah.
Over these two legs.
I think so.
And they've beaten teams that have better pedigrees than Spurs and better players. And I don't care about Spurs' intensity. And the intensity of the Premier League. Football's intense no matter where you go. Like, it's an intense
Spurs,
game.
Spurs are going into this after some really, really tough fixtures. Ajax had the weekend free because the Eredivisie gave the entire league the weekend off just to allow Ajax the best chance of winning this game. Whereas Spurs are going into
which, like, by the way, is like
unprecedented.
Yeah, but like, why doesn't this happen more? Like, it's where
TV
like
money.
But the FA are like doing anything they can to stop teams do well in Europe and the other countries as well. It just seems mad.
Yeah, FA has a strange relationship with UEFA and the Champions League.
The Netherlands recognises the importance of a Dutch team winning the Champions League. In England, to be honest, it doesn't really matter. If an English team wins the Champions League, great. But really, what does it matter? Because they're making so much money anyway. But for the Netherlands, this is all about showing that, yes, even in this crazy world where money, like, because it's only a couple of years ago that we said we'll never see an Ajax situation like 95 again. Yep. And yet here we are on the cusp of it again if they get into this final. And like, I mean,
They want to put in the Dutch league want to ingrain in the, let's say, up and coming player in Vitesse Arnhem, saying you should go to Ajax. Don't go to Sevilla. Don't make that sense. Go to Ajax.
Don't make
first.
The mistake that Patrick Kluivert's son made.
Yeah, go to Roma. Don't make the jump straight to like a tier one club or a club just below it, like a tier two club in the league or England, and kind of maybe waste away. Go to Ajax. Stay in the country. Play for the best. Yeah, or PSV or Feyenoord.
Because even look at the likes of like Nathan Ake moved to like Chelsea when he's like 15, 16 or whatever it is, and. Yeah, he's had a decent career. He's at Bournemouth, but I think he would have been better off actually staying in his country, like, coming through the youth system, actually playing Champions League football at first team.
Stay
level.
In your country, exactly. Says Raf.
Well, like, all like
stay in your country. You'd be better off.
Donald Trump esque.
You know, I did not mean that.
Stay in your country, Nathan Ake.
But the point still stands.
It goes to show, like, that it can be done, and. But just to go back, I was just amazed that like Ajax are joint top of the Eredivisie.
Yeah,
I don't know how you pronounce it, but I'm gonna
pronounce it right.
Yeah, I think you had a bang on there.
Yeah. And like they're playing Spurs, who have lost, as I was saying, is it 11, 12? I don't know how many games they've lost now. They lost against West Ham at the weekend. You know, they beat Man City, granted, in the Champions League, but it was very much a look at the draw kind of thing in the end.
Like 2 years ago, City go through. Like, you know, no VAR, no, like,
And by the looks
of it, Spurs deserved to go through.
They haven't shown anything to me to suggest they're this all conquering team. Like, I mean, they're a team that, like, have had no investment in it in the past year, and it's showing now as they, you know, fall towards the end of the season. They got a bit of a boost from moving to the new stadium. That appears to be gone now. And, like, it's no surprise that this team that has been playing incredibly well, I think, what, did they beat Real Madrid 4-1 in the Bernabeu this season?
Hammered them.
You know, they beat Juventus. Like, these are all teams that would beat Spurs. Well, Juventus, I think, would beat, you know, I think you could argue they'd beat Spurs. But, like, Real Madrid, sure.
It's the type of clubs that Ajax have been beating. They've not just been beating really informed Porto.
Or fluking their way to victories, either.
They walked over Porto.
Was it 4-1 at the Bernabeu? That's incredible.
They came back. Juve came back from 2-0 down against Atletico, and that is absolutely unheard of.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For Atletico to ship three goals like that, they're a really, really strong side.
And like, it will be fantastic for football if Ajax do beat them.
The only thing you'd be concerned about them is coming into many of the big ties, and they've had some remarkable performances and victories. I think you need to distress the performances as well, because they've played some absolutely beautiful football, and they've gone to the big teams and they've kept to their methods, and they have ripped teams apart. Some of the bigger teams in Europe ripped them apart. The only thing that I don't think there's anyone can really question their football and ability or the football and system that they have in place. But what the only thing you'd be a little worried is they've gone into a lot of these games kind of as the underdog. You know, if they get into the final, is that going to be a bit, there's going to be an insane amount of hype with them. Is the pressure going to come? That's the only thing you would kind of worry from their point of view in this tie. Like, well, footballing is fine, but you see some teams like, oh, there's kind of this crest of weight, and then the final is this big, big moment, and people actually, they're no longer the underdog in a certain way. They're still like, whoever they get, if they get through.
It'd be very interesting if they were playing, like, is that, the reality is, if they somehow made it, and they're playing Liverpool or Barcelona. But
it's a European paros. It's experienced.
But they'll be everyone will be. It'll be interesting. It'll be an interesting scenario in that, like, everybody was supporting Ajax, bar the club's own supporters.
I wouldn't be like Liverpool. Would never know what to do if everyone else wanted them to fail with it.
But even like, you know, because like sometimes if Barcelona are playing a certain club, some people would be up for Barcelona. But I think in this situation, everybody would be up for Ajax. Other than, you know, but like it is, but it should be no surprise that they're winning here. I mean,
no. Like if you're going into this game, you've kind of gone through very detailed there. The struggles that Spurs have had recently, it's a small squad, it's the hangover from the World Cup, but they're not in good form. And the fact that, you know, Lorenzo, no disrespect to him, is starting in such a key game for them kind of speaks volumes. And they really are struggling.
Just after losing Jan Vertonghen there.
Yeah, he doesn't look good. He doesn't look in a good way.
He looked like a concussion.
Well, yeah, didn't look good.
Yeah, I think
he thought he was going to get sick on the pitch.
He looked like he kind of spat up some blood there at one stage. It might only be a little nick or whatever, but yeah, no, he doesn't look in a good way. But like, this is such a big opportunity, like a second away goal, and
oh, you're in trouble.
There's a big, because you like Tottenham are the bigger team here, but they don't have European experience. They're not that seasoned European pro. This is a new territory for them as well, so that's another struggle for them.
Bigger team maybe individually, but smaller club by a mile.
Well, absolutely.
In terms of history, of course.
I don't mean to be picking out Gary Breenford, but it just, that's, I think reading that headline and that, reading some of the opinions, he was like, it just looks like a pundit, and look, I'm only saying how I feel of it, and look, he's entitled to his opinion, and he tried to break down how, oh look, he's seen Ajax, in fairness he said he's watched Ajax a lot, and he said he thinks, his opinion was, Spurs won't be able to cope with Ajax won't be able to cope with Spurs intensity. But I just think, given the evidence on, like, it's a bad take, and it looks like a biased Premier League lazy punditry take.
My opinion would be Spurs have, intensity has kind of evaporated. It's evaporated just, for the past, all of the evidence is there
that Ajax are about to win. Maybe not convincingly 5-1. It's still the semi-final. You think teams will get up for it, but they're gonna win. And just like, it just looks like that. Exactly what I was talking about. Goals that kind of blind anything else that's happening. No matter what's happening in the Dutch league, just because it's there, it's gonna be all of a different stat. It's just naturally gonna be worse than the fourth or third best team in the Premier League.
I made a point recently, I'm not talking about Gary Breen here or Paul Scholes or anybody, but I made a point recently to a friend of mine and said, there's plenty of ex-footballers who haven't a clue about football.
Yeah, well, that's true.
You know, they played the game and they did what they needed to do, and if they were a centre forward, they knew how to finish, and if they were a winger, they knew how to chase after a ball, maybe put in a good cross, whatever they needed to do. But a lot of them don't have a clue about the actual game in general. And overall, and analysing a game, they might be able to analyse a centre forward's job if they're a former centre forward or what have you. But they can't maybe look at the game overall and see tactically how the game is set out, because they're just not used to having to do that. All they have had to do for the last 20 years is get on the end of a chance or put in a cross or do what they need to do.
Make
that tackle. Take orders.
Thierry Henry is a good example of that, because he, I think we'll all agree, he was, even though he's getting paid the most by Sky, he was by far and away Sky's worst pundit.
Yeah.
And there was this great clip that everyone references where he's breaking down Barcelona's play under Pep Guardiola, and it's one of the biggest clips from Thierry Henry's time in Sky. And I was talking about this off air with Nathan Murphy, like, maybe he understands to the extent of which Pep Guardiola explained it to him, but he doesn't know what it actually means in a broader system. For like, and you see that going into his management system, his management teams now.
Yeah, his Monaco.
He switched around. I think he played six or seven different formations in the short time that he was there.
Yeah. Like, how do you mean you're not doing it? And by all accounts, he'd gone out and he made a fool out of a couple of players. You know,
there's a Russian player on the Monaco team, and Henri's got a new job at New York Red Bulls now. But he's the new coach. Yeah. But he basically he'd tell the team what to do, And then he basically starts screaming at them about 4 minutes later. And then he run onto the pitch and show them how to do it. And like, I can't remember the name of the Russian player, but he was saying that.
Oh, no, he was one of the World Cup players.
He was one of the World Cup players. Yeah, yeah. He was saying, perhaps.
Golovin.
Yeah. And he was basically saying, I don't think he realized that we don't have players other than Fabregas. And he mentioned somebody else. We don't really have players as good as him in Monaco.
It's a classic example of an ex-pro not understanding why you're not as good as they were.
And Roy Keane had that.
I was just about to say, in his book, he says the exact
Roy Keane has that problem.
He was going to say, I had that. The biggest problem I had at Sunderland in my early years, and this was a book written about after Roy Keane had such a successful Sunderland. But I had these, you're going to say the point, he had the exact problem. The biggest problem he had was not running on the pitch and showing players how to do it. And he did it.
And not understanding how a player can't do exactly what he used to do. I'm telling you how to make that pass or make that.
Which goes back to the punditry point where he was talking about whoever, I think Fred not running back or whatever it is. Yeah.
Fred just can't play that pass, or maybe he doesn't understand. Or
he's been told not to do what you're criticising him of. Yeah. You know, like I think it was at Owen Hargreaves or someone said, or maybe Steve McManaman, they mix him up sometimes. All this nonsense white noise sometimes.
They both have good hair.
That's the thing.
That's what you know.
But they're both been told, like, I've been criticising the media for doing this thing over and over again. They're slating me. I got like a 2 out of 10. And I was like, my manager told me to do that. I was told to keep doing it.
Absolutely.
And if I didn't do it, I'd be dropped. So he was like, hit the ball down that right channel, and it's like, it looked like he's aimlessly. But that's
because, slow down the game or whatever needs to be done.
I was looking like an idiot because the other player who's meant to be running down that channel wasn't doing what he was supposed to do. So I was looking like an idiot, misplacing passes. Whereas I was told, don't even look down the channel, that person will be there. And I look like an idiot giving away the ball 10 times, look like getting a 2 out of 10 on the paper because I've given away the ball 10 times, even though I'm doing exactly what you told me to
and
do.
And that's how the game has evolved to such an extent that these pundits don't really understand it because they didn't have the same analysis and the micro plays that they have. Yeah. Like I read somewhere that Poch has a system where if Vertonghen's dribbling with the ball with his right foot outside, that's a signal for Dele Alli to make a run down a channel. And I mean, Roy Keane didn't have to deal with that. Roy Keane had to deal with playing the ball out to Ryan Giggs or David Beckham, knowing they would be out wide and up near the box. That's all he had to deal with. He didn't have to deal with these systems.
Alex Ferguson didn't do tactics.
It all comes with a trick, and I got you.
Oh yeah, it's the circle of life. The virtuous circle always returns.
You were right
all
along.
What did you say again?
I'm not going to repeat it.
When Pep Guardiola took over at Man City, one of the first things he did was divide the pitch up into a grid and show everyone where.
It's fascinating.
It was like when the ball is here, you all need to be here, and that's how he.
I'd love to see Pep do. Analysis.
Punditry.
I'd love to see him.
Even I'd say it's incredibly complicated. I don't think he'd be able to explain it. He'd be just like saying guys every six.
Yeah. But like even looking at a passage of play and kind of describing why it went that way, I'd love to actually hear him talking. Obviously, he's not going to tell us now what he's still managing, but in 5 or 6 years' time,
I always wonder what's he saying to Mikel Arteta. I mean, he just seems to shout at him from most of the game. Arteta just stares out at the pitch.
I remember when he started doing punditry, he just finished. Damien Duff said he found it very hard to communicate what he thinks about football into words, like how he played or what, like his advice. He found it very hard to steal advice. I see now that he relies on sports analysis gigs and coaching that he stopped saying that in public because that wouldn't be exactly what you want your coach to be saying. Like, can't tell you how to play football. But I think it's very honest and probably very true. Like, he has this something in him that is very innate and very reactionary.
Yes.
That's my point about, like, say centre forwards know where to be when the ball comes in the box. Yeah. But how do you tell a young lad where you need to be? You just know. Or a left winger.
This is where natural talent comes into it.
Absolutely.
There's an element of natural talent.
Yeah, it's like Kenny Dalglish, apparently. He used to use, I think, the shadows of the defenders to, it's something about his runs anyway, but like that's innate stuff that he just has. Like, you can't really.
No.
Like, or it's very difficult to teach that.
Even if you told someone to do that, it wouldn't come naturally to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of my point about a lot of footballers wouldn't know a whole lot about how to tell a young player or how to actually read the game because they just did it. Everything they did came naturally to them, especially the very, very talented players, the likes of those we're seeing.
I think a lot of managers don't know how to deal with young players, period. I think millennials and the way people we are engaged with was raised genuinely in it's. I know, and footballers are kind of a little subset of humans in their own way. They don't live by the normal day to day that we might live, but genuine likes of Pogba, likes of those, they've not been raised in the same way, same academy system, same like just school of thought that player like Graham Souness, who had to like clean boots and like really grind, you know, some of the, if you're a star at 15, you're held up to be like, you know, earning a lot of money. You don't need to be clean bloody boots. Even it might be in the club's program, but you can. It's just a different. I think that there's a lot of bad management of young talent these days and misreading of why they're being petulant, why they are like this, and it's probably that they've made these people themselves by paying them lots of money far too early in their career.
And the proper football man will say that the systems are treating them like childs, and that's why there's so much player power these days, acting as if it's a bad thing that these kids have what they need to develop to the highest standards.
Leeds.
It's all the avocado toast.
It's all the avocado.
That's the problem. I think we were, just before we go to the Granemark interview, just Liverpool's throwing coach, I think we were going to bring up Leeds versus Villa very briefly. So,
does anyone think that Leeds were wrong to keep playing?
No.
No.
Yeah. Leeds were wrong. No.
He's just asking the question.
I think that goal should have stood. I will be with the defender trying to kick that ball out.
I think that the rule is just so. It's not.
I had a big argument with someone on Twitter about it.
Gentleman's agreement is it's stupid.
It's such a grey area. Yeah. It makes it so great. The referee has to blow it up or else just keep playing.
Yeah.
I had an argument with someone on Twitter who said that he would actually. Now, he had a point here. It was a guy who works for Who Scored saying that. This clip has been taken in isolation, but actually Villa kicked the ball out when a Leeds player went
yes,
down.
Yes, they did.
That
yeah, now, that's
now,
what caused
which,
so much
which is what's causing yeah, which is why it's like you hassled us. I think you know it's. I think you're your own fool for kicking it out in that situation, and you.
Yeah,
can't,
you should never ever kick the ball out of play.
Look, if you're going to kick the ball, it's your decision. Don't say I influence you. I can check. You didn't have to do what I said when I was asking to kick it out. It's like a player saying,
especially when the Villa player in question seems to be trying to foul the Leeds
player. And then the argument was made, but the Villa player went off injured. It's like, but what's to stop someone coming on and bringing him off?
The players / referee will always know if it's like a career threatening injury or a head injury or whatever.
And they're meant to stop for a head injury.
Well, the head injury will stop anyway straight away.
And if it's a serious injury at all, the referee should be like, okay, listen.
But this case, it was not a head injury. He was down. And
they know from the challenge that he's not going
to. It comes down to this thing that like, oh well, you know, you're down a man if your man is lying on the pitch, so we'll kick it out of play. But like, what if it's the 89th minute?
Yeah.
I mean, are you going to like go? Sure, I can lie down here and they'll kick the ball out of play.
Well, you can imagine some sort of managers. I'm not sure, maybe a Mourinho or somebody who can be quite cynical would actually use that as a tactic.
The defender who made the tackle. I don't know what was his name.
Pontus Janssen.
That's gas. I mean, what was he doing? I mean, like, obviously they've been told.
I think that's brilliant.
Obviously they've been told. Like, I completely agree.
He was trying to make a point. He was trying to protest.
But he nearly
stopped.
Keno,
I know.
Like,
I think he's trying to show I'm not.
The
happy
ball was
with
there.
This.
I think. No, like it was like the point
back
was
to Roy Keane again.
Yeah. No, but like the point is, obviously they've been told. Okay, we're going to let Villa score a goal here, and then he tries to do. I don't know what he was doing.
I completely agree with that.
Well,
though,
Kenny Cunningham,
it's absolute nonsense that they would decide to. If this was an actual competitive game that meant something, that had a lasting impact on the table, they're not letting Aston Villa score. So why would they let them score regardless? It was absolutely ridiculous. I think the only argument you can make against Janssen doing that in the first place is if he's actually successful in that and kicks the ball out of play, he's going to bring the game into disrepute and. A lot of the Leeds players are going to get suspended for the playoffs. That's the only argument I can see against Janssen doing that.
Yeah, that's a good point.
What do you mean?
So we saw the malaise after the goal.
You mean?
Can you imagine if Bielsa told Leeds to let Aston Villa score, then Janssen protests against that, wins the ball, kicks the ball out of play?
Be more of an uproar.
It's going to be a
massive
melee,
okay.
And there's going to be several
more
players sent off. He's going to be done for bringing.
My
the
point,
game
obviously, Bielsa told him to let the goal stand, and then he tried to make this last.
It would have been amazing if he. It would have been amazing.
Would they have thrown the ball back to them then? Afterwards?
Like, it would have just been pandemonium if he cleared the ball. I mean, I would have loved to have watched what would have happened. Would he have stopped the goal happening again?
After Villa got the goal, John Terry still having a go at Bielsa. John Terry is John Terry.
The interesting thing about this, Leeds have been playing quite poorly for a while now. And I do think that actually this might galvanise the team and drive them forward because it brings them back into the spotlight. Other than people talking about it, Leeds are actually, you know, their season is falling apart when they're in the heat. now you kind of go, well, now they're going to have, there's going to be some, like, I mean, the judging by the writing, there seems to be a fairly consensus that it will be a Villa-Leeds playoff final. And most people seem to think that Villa and Leeds...
Villa are in very good form. Yeah.
And like, you'd Leeds will be so fired up for that in particular after all this. And I have to say, I like Bielsa as a manager. I mean, I do.
He's a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, and I thought, like, I mean, the training ground stuff was just like such a. I was like, Christ Almighty, people need to get a grip of themselves.
At the moment, it's Leeds, West Brom, Villa, Derby are the four who look like they're going to be in it.
There's only one game left. Like,
well, Leeds and Villa, are again probably going to be the playoff final. I mean, I don't know. I'm kind of torn about who I want to see go up. I love to see. Like both of them in the Premier League group, perfectly honest. I wouldn't mind seeing Villa or Leeds, but I'd like to see
Leeds
both of them.
Leeds rot in the Championship for the rest.
I have to say, I'd much prefer Leeds.
Yeah, I'd love Leeds back.
Yeah, I like, that's my point. I'm kind of quite torn about it.
I grew up with Leeds shoes. Just being there.
I hope it's not West Brom or Derby. Like, no. That'd be a bit boring.
You could argue that it would have been... more astute of Leeds history if they didn't allow Villa to score, like, and
that's what I mean. It was the most Leeds goal of all time. Brilliant.
It would have been a real
argument you could make about Leeds going up, that you can get this, I don't know what you call it, like football bastardness or something.
but in fairness to him, he understood straight away that this
he's become much more aware of trying to not come across as crazy.
He used to have
doesn't help himself.
He used to have open training sessions at Bilbao, and he stopped doing that. Then he had no problem doing it. But I think the reason he stopped doing it was because he realized everyone in Spain thought this was really weird. And he was like, this is actually becoming an issue, the fact that I want to have open training sessions. So he just stopped because it was customary not to have it in Spain, open training sessions. And I presume he quickly realized what was going on here was that, you know, this goal will dominate the next couple of weeks, so we can't let this happen. It's a bit like, in fairness, with Arsenal and Sheffield United back in the FA Cup, in 98, 99. When Kanu and Overmars combined to score a goal, and Kanu said afterwards he didn't realise that, you know, you were meant to stop play, and then Wenger just offered the replay and Arsenal went and beat them, and that was the end of it.
Motherwell actually scored a much worse goal against Celtic this year. Celtic had a player down injured, the ball was kicked out of play, but instead of the play stopping, the Motherwell player picks up the ball, throws it to his man, he's in on goal, and Motherwell score.
You could probably argue that Motherwell need these kind of advantages.
Which seeks us brilliantly into throw-ins, actually. Thanks for doing that inadvertently. So myself and Jonathan were chatting to the Liverpool throw-in coach. His name is Thomas Granemark, and I started by asking him how he went from working around bobsled, or at least in terms of his athletics career, and then in actual pure athletics as well, and then going into football and working with throw-ins particularly.
Oh, I've been playing football myself for approximately 18 years as a kid and as a youth player, and I could make a very long throw in, and I could also run very fast. So in my early 20s, I changed sport to athletics, and the first year I was training, I was going on the Danish national team in 100, 200, 400 meters, and I had a pretty good athletics career. The best result was a couple of Danish championships, and also in 2000 we were winning the 4x400 meter European Championship for clubs in Paris. So I had a pretty successful athletics career, but in 2002 I hadn't been better, just been setting personal records on 100 and 200 meters, but I was moving to another part of the country, Denmark, and the western part, because I just met my wife, and I was, instead of training with a big group, I was training alone. So I thought, hey, I had to change sports, and I knew it had to be a team sport because I loved that as a footballer too. I just knew that it shouldn't be a sport who was too violent or too risky or so. So because I've always been afraid of roller coasters as a kid, but I chose the bobsleigh sport, and that may sound a little bit strange because you're driving approximately 130 to 150 kilometers per hour, but I didn't puke or so when I was driving in the bobsleigh. So, but it was, you know, 100 times tougher than a roller coaster. So, but in the middle of this bobsleigh period in 2004, I thought, hey, if I can make a long throw in myself as a football player, can't I teach other football players to do it? Then I went down to my local library after a bobsleigh trip and tried to find that book about the long throw in. But there was no books at all, and I had to make a throw in course myself. So I used approximately 6 months to do that. And I thought I'd be happy if I could coach a youth team or a amateur team in the throw-ins, but I was so lucky to have a Danish Super League team as my first team. It's called the Viborg FF, the team, and they were very successful with the long throw-ins, and yeah, it was a success. And since then, I've been coaching a lot of teams, and in the start, first couple of years, it was only the long throw-ins, but now I'm focusing on the long, the fast, and the clever throw-ins. So yeah, it's exciting.
It's interesting though, because obviously there's a lot of attention on free kicks, corners, and everything else. The throw-ins happen about 40 to 50 times a game, which there should be a lot more importance placed on them. But it is a bit weird in football, something that happens so regularly, not so much thought has been given to it until now, and until you've kind of come along.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a little bit crazy because, as you said, it's approximately 40 to 50 times in a match, and we have had several matches in Liverpool where we had, I can remember a match against Everton where there were 63 throw-ins. So it's not a thing that's happening a few times in a match. It happens a lot of times, and if I should compare Liverpool FC right now with the other teams, for example, if you compare the possession after throwing under pressure while the players are marked, then we are bashing the other teams totally. And normally most teams have possession in under 50% of the occasions when they have a throw-in under pressure, and normally in Liverpool we have between 75 and 100% possession when we have a throw-in under pressure. So I'm not counting all the easy throw-ins when there are no markings, but all the throw-ins when the players are under pressure, we have a very high margin of possession. Now, for example, when we met Bayern Munich in the Champions League, the first leg, Bayern Munich had only 28% possession. So that's the thing I'm working with in Liverpool FC. First of all, trying to keep possession, because if you have possession, you can score a goal, create chances, or have control. And if you lose the ball, you're often caught out of balance because you have a offensive mind or attacking mindset there, and if you lose the ball, then it's very dangerous. So a lot of people are thinking that the throwing coach, he's when does Liverpool score from a long throw-in? But we're not really taking any long throw-ins in Liverpool, even though we have Joe Gomez with a world-class throw-in. But we have scored a lot of goals doing the things we're doing in training, and so it's keeping possession, creating chances, and so. But there's just no one who sees it, and that's perfect, because then it's a little secret in Liverpool FC, and that's a big advantage for us. So. Yeah,
it's something you've clearly. I've spoke to you before off air as well. I can tell how passionate you are. I can tell how much pride it gives you when you ream off the Liverpool stats there, how they're able to improve their possession rates. Does it frustrate you then after, like, you've put almost your life into this? I think it's over 15 years, I believe. You have, you know, you went from going down to your local library, not being able to find any information on to designing your own training plan, and then going on to implement that, various different styles in various different clubs in different leagues. Does it frustrate you then when you hear other people, maybe that we'd call them with the older mindset of the game, that may not be as acceptable or kind of maybe a little bit mocking? I know the big thing that came to life really was after your appointment at Liverpool was the Andy Gray stuff. I'm sure you've heard it a million times. We're pretty much mocking you in a way. Does that hurt after something you've spent so much of your time involving with, that people are a little bit more kind of negative towards it?
No, it doesn't hurt me at all, because I think when people are doing that, it's because of a lack of knowledge. It's because people don't know the numbers. People don't know how you can work with the players. A lot of people are just thinking, hey, we're just throwing it down the line. And a lot of coaches are saying, oh, it's better to lose the ball 30 meters down the pitch than 15 meters down the pitch. But why not think, hey, why not keep possession? Why not keep chances in another way, create chances in another way? So I'm not offended by people who are negative about it. The only frustration I've been having in my throwing career is that the first 10, 12 years or so, people were only interested in the long throw-ins. I've been having a lot of success with the long throw-ins. For example, I had two clubs last year in Denmark scoring 10 goals each after the long throw-in, and then one of the clubs were FC Midtjylland, who were Danish champions, still coaching them this year. So of course, I can help a lot of clubs who are focusing on set pieces to score a lot of goals with the long throw-in. But for me, it's I think it's more enjoyable to look at these fast and clever throw-ins, because it fits to every club's playing style. So you don't have to have a team with big and tall guys. So that's I think the best thing about being in Liverpool. Of course, it's fantastic to coach a gigantic club like this and being a fan too. It's out of another world. But the best thing is perhaps that they can see how important all these throw-ins all over the pitch are, so for me it's okay. I think that more and more people will just see the magic in the throw-ins, because it's a little defensive thinking don't look at the throw-ins when there are so many.
The fast throw-in actually is something you kind of raised there, and as Jonathan would know, Liverpool's players aren't exactly the biggest physically, bar Van Dijk. So obviously the offside rule with a throw-in makes the fast throw-in makes it more relevant in a sense. So was that something Klopp was very keen to implement as well, given his style is actually counter-attacking and trying to use pace on the break with the likes of Mane, Salah, and then Firmino?
Yeah, I think every coach should try to implement it. And of course, that was only also one of the things Jurgen Klopp wanted to have in the game itself for Liverpool. But it's the fast counter attack throw-in is only a little part of the fast throw-ins. We have a lot of things not only with the counter attack but all around the pitch where we try to focus on the fast delivery. And it's not, you can't just only say that you have to throw it fast and you have more space, because if you throw it fast in the wrong circumstances or if there are created the real space and so, then it's not an advantage to throw fast. So we worked on all these fast throw-ins, but also the clever throw-ins, how when to throw fast, when to wait, how to create space, and how the different players on the pitch can move, so we can have an advantage of the throw-in, what we should do in different parts of the pitch. And so we've done it all, and I'll say that of course we've been starting Liverpool have been starting from scratch when I started in mid-July, but right now I'll say that we are on a very top level at the throw-ins, and it's also very important when you want to keep control of a match, because You can avoid all the dangerous chances from the opponents, at least by not losing a ball at a throw-in. So the throw-ins is not only about scoring goals and creating chances, but also keeping sure that you're holding the opponent tight against your body, so they can't really move.
Yeah, just looking back then, and when I'm just looking back to your appointment to Liverpool, and one of the things that kind of struck me really at the time was when Jurgen Klopp was describing the role. Like, he was very open. He said, "Look, I've never heard of the throw-in role." I believe he came across you in an article in Sportsbeeb in one of the German newspapers, and that led to your contact. Can you tell us how your move to Liverpool came about, really?
Yeah, it was. As I said before, I've been coaching several Danish professional clubs, also some smaller clubs from other countries. But yeah, there's just been an article in the German Bild, and I think it was in the end of June last year. And in the start of July, I was going on a trip with my family, my wife and my two kids, and we were visiting a chocolate shop. Yeah, I had my no voice on my telephone, and I just had to look at the telephone before we went in to buy some chocolate, and then I could see there was a plus 44 number who has been calling, and I just had to check it, because if you have a company like me, it could might as well be a guy who wants to sell some pens or something like that. So I just listening to the voicemail, and then it was Jürgen Klopp on the voicemail. I was totally in shock, because I didn't see it coming. So I tried to call him back again, but he didn't take the phone, because perhaps it was several minutes before he had made the call himself. So I just thought, hey, I just want to go home and try to make the call in more quiet surroundings. And so I was driving my car, and my wife was sitting beside me, the kids in the back. And then suddenly the phone rang, and my wife took the phone up, and she said, "It's Jürgen." And I just took the car and then drove into a grass field. It was totally secure. No one was in danger. And then I took the call with Jürgen Klopp in the middle of a grass field. So then he invited me to Melwood the week after, and it was only going to be a meeting, but he was so I won't say impressed, but he was so convinced about the things I said that I got the chance to coach 21 players from the Premier League team the day after. It was all the players who weren't on vacation or injured or so. And since then I've been coaching Liverpool approximately 1 week per month. And all the weeks I'm not in England, then I'm analyzing all the throw-ins we have in the game. And I've just been sitting with the throw-ins from the game against Huddersfield, and we had 100% possession in this game, so with the throw-ins under pressure. So I'm doing a lot of work with Liverpool, so it's not only when I'm in the club or on training camp, it's almost a daily part of my work life in Denmark too. So.
Yeah, and I noticed that even watching the FA Youth Final last week, Liverpool versus Man City, you could even notice, I think Reece Williams had kind of the longer throw, but you could definitely notice your methods kind of working the way down in the academy. Is that something that's involved with you with your role at Liverpool, not just the first team, to kind of work on the whole, like Jürgen kind of speaks with, now we have the academy move coming together where it's all one kind of style of football and it's one football and language almost. Is that part of your work as well, just working away from the first team as well?
Yeah, it is. I'll say that I haven't been working so much with the academy as I've been doing with the Premier League team, because it had to be when it's fit in. And so, but I've been working with the U23s and U18s, and we've been working with the same philosophy. So so for me, it's a kind of philosophy. It's a part of the game. Like you can have tiki taka and you can have a counter tech game, or you can have some kind of game, then it's the same with the throw-ins. It's a philosophy. It's not a lot of people think it's about, okay, you also do some systems and so on, and of course you can do a lot of agreements and so on the team and do some certain things, and we also do, but it's a lot about the philosophy. Like you have a philosophy in basketball, you have a philosophy in any other sports where you are, some things are integrated. That's what I'm trying to do in Liverpool, and I think it's worked very fine, and even much better than I thought it could be before all this. So.
Yeah, I suppose a final point before we let you go. So you have the world record for the longest throw-in, so 51 metres, 33. It was a front flip. People can check it out on your YouTube channel if they want to see it.
Yeah.
But there's a player you worked with previously in Denmark. It's Danish international, Andreas Poulsen. Your work with his throw-in, it improved from 25 metres up to 37.9. So in terms of what you do individually with a person, in terms of body technique and everything, in his case, for example, what did you work on with him to try and improve that side of his game?
Yeah, and to be precise, because what you're saying with the 25, I've been saying some medias, but it's actually from 24.25 to 37.9, so almost 14 meters. So, but what I've done with him, like I do with every other player, also all the players from Liverpool, is I'm using, if you're looking at the long throw in, I'm using video analysis. I'm looking at between 25, 30 different technical parameters, and then I'm seeing how can this specific player improve. Of course, there are some general things for all players, but then I'm looking at the video analysis, and most players are improving between 5 and 10 meters and some even up to 15 meters. And a lot of perhaps coaches out there or players out there who are playing with a, you know, with a more fast playing style like Liverpool or a bit more tiki-taka like City or Barcelona, they think, oh, why should we even have a long throw in when we're not doing long throw ins towards the goals? But that's because the longer throw in you have, the greater throw in area you also have. And one of the easiest way to get possession from the opponent is to make a throw in under pressure. And for example, if you take this Andreas Paulsen, if you look at the half circle he had when he made his 24.25 meters, then it was 923 square meters. But if you look at the half circle of the 37.90 meters, then it's 2256 meters. So he improved his throwing area by more than double, 2.2 times. So, and if you're only looking at the length of the throw and the area of the throw, then it's a big advantage to throw longer because you can throw to more teammates. And of course, you have all the other things with precision and the feeling of the throw and how to create space and so on and so on. So I like to say that even though you're a fullback or a coach who are not making the long throw-ins towards the opponent's goal, then it's very important that you throw your fullbacks can throw as long as possible. They don't necessarily have to be the world best, but as long as possible, that's very important.
Yeah, and of course, these are all the kind of marginal gains that are pushing Liverpool to the brink of a title. Thomas, thanks a million for taking the time to chat to us, and hopefully, well, I don't hope, but Jonathan certainly hopes. You don't just get the 97 points, but that you do finish ahead of Manchester City. But best of luck with that. And anyway, best of luck with the work you're doing as well, because it seems to be definitely having an effect.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, that is the Thomas Granemark interview. It's also podcasted separately if you're looking for it on iTunes. It's also up on YouTube where you can see our lovely mugs as well and his very nice office. And that's pretty much it, I think, for this week's show. So, Joe Coffey.
Raf, pleasure
man.
As always.
Derek Ryan.
Thank you, Raf.
End of call.
Cheers, Raf.
See you in New York, Raf.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks, Raf.
Are we doing an OB, are we?
Well, look, if the money comes through.
Money.
Yeah, exactly, what money. Killian Woods, thanks for feeding us that clip of Scholes on Piatt.
Sorry, Raf, I cut across your outro for Jonathan there. Apologies.
Did I? Oh, yeah, Jonathan.
Thanks,
good
Raf.
Stuff. And good work on the Granemark interview as well, because you actually sorted it out. So that needs to be pointed out. So that's it for this week's show. Take it away, Johan.